Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and once a week here on Radio Boston, we take some time to break down and review the story of the week. This week, it's transportation. It has been a rough go for the T since the tragic Red Line accident last month.
They say a man got his arm caught in the train's door, and he was dragged as the train left Broadway Station.
The train involved is an older one, built in 1969-1970.
The T's general manager is defending the system as safe, even as federal transportation officials raise some serious questions.
And those questions are being asked by the Federal Transit Administration. News breaking this week that the FTA is investigating safety concerns at the T. Now, that's something Governor Baker sees as a positive.
I actually welcome the FTA.
And all of that on top of some serious financial trouble.
The agency is on the edge of a financial cliff.
We've had a bit of a reprieve, but I think doomsday is finally coming.
Thanks to NBC 10 and WCVB Channel 5 for some of that sound, so let's dig into it. Jim Aloisi is a former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and a board member of the group Transit Matters, which advocates for better, more reliable public transit. Jim, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. So earlier this week, just after the FTA news came out, you tweeted a tweet string. That's a hard thing for me to say. Tweet string. We're not going to do that one again. And you started with, quote, "I have great confidence the T is safe," end quote. So why start there? Why did you want to say, hey, it's still safe to ride? It suggests that people think it's not safe to ride.
I think that people can get that impression, which I think is wrong impression. And I think that those of us who care deeply about public transportation in Metro Boston and who advocate for a better system need to stress at the outset that we think it's safe. I mean, I take the T regularly, almost daily. So from a personal perspective, I find it safe. And I think we have to take into account that we've got a large old system and things will happen, and the things that happen, obviously, we would like not to have happened, but that doesn't necessarily translate into saying the T is unsafe. Look, there are on average 12 to 15 automobile collisions in Boston every single day. The last data I saw statewide goes back a couple of years to 2020. In 2020, in Massachusetts, 286 people were killed in automobile crashes, right? 76,000 crashes. We don't hear anybody saying that the highway system's unsafe, stop using it. In fact, we use it more often now, unfortunately, than we have in the past. So a lot of it is perspective. And I think that those of us who want to make sure that the T is the safest it can be want to say at the outset that it is safe.
All right. Because I don't want to create a drumbeat of it's not safe, it's not safe, it's not safe, right? So that's not what I'm doing in this follow-up question. And yet I do want to flag that we have had a number of serious, we've had two deaths, a number of serious injuries, multiple investigations, the Green Line crash last year, the tragic death of Robinson Lallin earlier this month by the NTSB. It does feel like a string of physically dangerous outcomes for T riders over the last year or so.
I think that's right. And I think that it's a good thing that we have through the FTA going to have a renewed focus on safety. The former T board, the Fiscal Management and Control Board, as you know, back in 2019, knew that safety needed to be addressed in a much more specific and holistic way. They put a panel of experts together. They had a report, and it was pretty clear then that the T needed to step up its game, and they hired a highly regarded fellow to run the safety program. They've got some good people there doing this, but, and here's the big but, the but is that we have a system that is old, that has equipment that's way past its useful life, in my judgment. We have a problem in terms of systems and signals that need repair. And we have had decades upon decades of disinvestment in the T. Now, this administration.
So I'm going to stop you there, right, only because I want to get to all these subjects and I want to kind of be able to handle them one at a time. So let's go back. You just mentioned the FTA. We started with that. So let's pick up there before we go to budget. All right. And yesterday, Governor Baker joined us here in Studio 2. I asked him about the FTA, the announcement. You know, the letter came from the FTA to the T last month. We learned about it after Boston Globe reporting this week. I asked him about it. Here he is.
What the FDA will bring, among other things, is a lot of information and a lot of knowledge about what the rest of the country does and how other systems manage some of their older lines and their older units. And and I think, in the grand scheme of things, a focus on sort of core operations and that sort of thing, especially with an organization that's actually seen a lot more than sort of certainly anybody has at the T, is a good thing.
And I want to hit that good thing, and I'm going to note you're on the Board of Transit Matters. They put out a statement this week basically saying not a good thing. But where I want to start is put it in perspective for us. How big a deal is it that the FTA is coming to Massachusetts to look at the MBTA this way?
It's a big deal. What we don't know is how big a deal. And so if it's the same big deal that occurred a few years ago in Washington, D.C.
The only other time the FTA has done this since they got the authority in 2012, right?
Correct. If it's that kind of big deal, then it's a serious problem, I believe, for public transportation. It may not be. So the first step in the process is for the FTA to do what it said it's doing in its letter, which is to begin what they call a safety management inspection of the T's operations and maintenance programs. That takes roughly, well, in Washington, when they did that, it took about 4 months. So they have to begin, and what I don't know, because I don't think it's been disclosed yet, is whether that safety management inspection has actually begun. But whenever it begins, let's say it will take around 4 months if it follows the Washington pattern to be accomplished. When that's finished, then there'll be a decision made about whether the T is able to handle the findings on its own or with additional oversight. And it's that question of additional oversight and who is providing the oversight and what are the terms and conditions that can be really troublesome. Because in Washington, it basically took away from the Washington system the power and authority to direct the safety program, put it in the hands of a what they call a state safety oversight agency.
Basically like receivership, right, Jim?
Yes, for that piece of the puzzle. And what concerns me, and I think many transit advocates, is that what will happen in that worst case scenario, and I want to stress, we don't know that this will be the result, but if it is that result, what happens is the FTA issues what they call safety directives. And they basically say, you must do this, you must do that. Those are generally, from an operations perspective, going to be unfunded mandates. Okay? That's the problem. The problem will become whether the FTA's safety directives put such a strain on the MBTA's already constrained operating budget that it creates a fiscal problem, the likes of which we haven't seen before, that threatens to push aside many of the worthwhile initiatives that most of us who care about public transportation want to see put into place over the next half dozen years.
Okay, here's a little sound from earlier this week. This is General Manager Steve Poftak, who was talking about being open to FTA feedback and recommendations. That's not the same as this sort of pseudo-receivership we were just talking about. He pointed out that the T is, that they've been putting in millions of dollars on safety. So this is a press conference on Tuesday at the Talbot Avenue commuter rail stop in Dorchester.
We can't rule out everything, but we are doing a tremendous amount of work. We're making a massive investment in modernizing the system and making it as safe as it possibly can be.
Now, you have talked a lot. I've been hosting here at Radio Boston for about 3 years now, and we've had a number of conversations over that time where you have raise concerns about just general lack of funding to get behind the kinds of investments that need to be made for short-term and long-term. Earlier this week in that Twitter thread, you were concerned that state lawmakers on Beacon Hill are, quote, kicking the can down the road, end quote, when it comes to funding. So do we have enough money in the system?
No. And I think it's important for me to quickly explain that the MBTA budget, people need to think about it as two standalone components. There's an operating budget and there's a capital budget. Now, it is true that the funding in the capital budget and the spending out of the capital budget, which is basically the budget that is used for building stuff, fixing stuff, it's the construction and repair budget, that has been more robust than ever before, and they're certainly making use of it. But you can't hire the kind of personnel that you need to manage projects, to do the kinds of training and the kinds of things that are directly related to safety and efficiency without a robust operating budget. It's the operating budget that pays the salaries and the fringe.
It's the day-to-day expenses.
The day-to-day expenses. The T has already said that they're expecting a $230 million shortfall next June in that budget. Now, the last fiscal report out of the T, which happened to come a day or so, is a lot more optimistic in terms of projections. And so I'm not expecting that shortfall at this point to be that high. However, if you begin to add FTA mandates, if that's where we're heading with the FTA, for more training, more project management personnel, more safety personnel, that's all going to come out of an operating budget that's groaning under the weight of having lost fair revenue as a result of the pandemic, fair revenue that's not coming back anytime soon. And I have called consistently on the legislature to please understand that they can't sit back and wait for a miracle to happen. And I think too many people, frankly, at the State House think that miracle will happen because the millionaire's tax will pass or because the federal government will step in. The federal government doesn't pay a dime toward operating costs. They haven't since 1980, and they're not going to start now.
So,
and the millionaire's tax is not the silver bullet that some people hope and expect it will be.
So, Jim, what I'm going to do here, because I do want to give us a second to talk about gas prices before we wrap, but I want to play you, and this is a little bit of a long cut from my conversation with Governor Baker about the MBTA yesterday, but I feel like it sums up his whole position. So here it is.
I said when I took office and we had that horrible winter that I was going to make sure that the T had resources to spend on investing in its core system. That's not where most people in public life want to spend money. They want to spend it on expansions and this and that, because that's where the public, you know, visibility is. A lot of the money that the T has spent over the past 7 or 8 years, you can't even see. But the bottom line is replacing all the tracks, replacing systems, replacing electronics, signals, switches, power systems. That's where the big opportunity to improve the quality of the service and the performance comes from. And it's not a place where you get much political benefit at all.
So just in a sentence, as a former transportation secretary, do you agree?
I don't agree fully. And I would say to the governor, with all due respect, yes. He has insisted on a focus on those particulars. But let me be clear. A safe system with fewer riders, a safe system that runs on an inequitable and an unsustainable fare policy, a safe system that fails to provide a high level of service quality and service frequency throughout the day is not the kind of public transportation system that the people of Metro Boston deserve or expect. And it's not the kind of public transportation system that will help us recover sustainably and equitably from the pandemic.
All right, before I let you go, I want to talk about gas prices for a second. Massachusetts set a new record high, not once, but at least four times this week as of yesterday. According to AAA today, the regular gallon price for gas is $4.48, rounded up. You served in the Deval Patrick administration. You were transportation secretary in 2009. We were in a recession. Any lessons from them that should be applied now as our commuters who are not on, I mean, even the T's over budget on fuel. So as people who are getting from point A to point B face these prices.
Well, there's very little that the state can do about it because the high prices in gasoline have nothing to do with state action, right? They're not related to the state gas tax by any stretch. This is all about the market forces, global market forces, and domestic market forces that have driven those costs up. That includes the response of oil drilling in the United States and it by OPEC countries in the aftermath of the drop in driving following the pandemic, right? They have yet to ramp it up. They meaning OPEC in particular, wants to stabilize the market for their own profit. In the United States, companies that were doing a lot of drilling reduced that during the pandemic. So unfortunately, public policy is not going to be able to do much about the cost of gas at the pump.
All right. That is Jim Aloisi, former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and a board member of the group Transit Matters, which advocates for better, more reliable public transit, and a pretty regular commentator on the all things transit for us. Jim, appreciate you helping us run down that story this week.
I hope it was helpful, Tatiana. Have a great weekend.
Very much so. You too. Hey, let's take a hike. Because, you know, we are doing that usual thing here in New England where we basically skip spring and go straight to summer this weekend. So it does seem like it's a great time to get outdoors. And what better way to bask in the beautiful weather ahead of us than to get out in nature and go for a hike? So we brought in a couple of outdoors and hiking enthusiasts to tell us about the best places to get our walk on this weekend. Joining us here in Studio 2, Renata Pomponi, Senior Regional Director at Mass Audubon. Renata, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to talk to people about getting outside and experiencing the nature of Massachusetts.
It's great to have you on the line. Also, we have Sarah Holman, author of the blog She Hikes Mountains. Sarah, welcome back to you.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, so Renata, I have to ask you how springtime hiking compares to other seasons. We've talked with you about winter hiking, for example. So what's the big gift or the big difference in your book?
Well, you know, spring is kind of our reward here in New England for making it through the winter. And, you know, you're sitting in your house, you're like, oh, it's too cold to get out. And it's that brief period before it's too hot. It feels like it's too hot to get out. This week, maybe that period was yesterday.
It was like a day.
you know, there's so much popping out in nature right now. And I think having the chance to experience that change of the season is just one of the privileges we have in our area. One of the things I'm really like tuning into this year is the plant life that's out there under your feet. So, you know, I was walking one of my favorite trails just a month ago, and it looked like all kind of snow, leaves. And then a few weeks ago, these little green plants started popping up everywhere, and different kinds, different shapes, different colors of green. And then, you know, today all of a sudden they had flowers. I was out this morning.
Just boom.
And boom, they're there. And, you know, those are called spring ephemerals. They're called ephemeral because their flowering season is so short. It's just they go out, they do their job, and then they're gone. And you might see the greenery for a little while longer, but those flowers are only a very specific time. And I really love walking the same trails over and over again so you can see those changes happening under your feet.
So, Sarah, do you prep for a hike in the spring differently than you would for, say, a hike in December or a hike in July?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there are certain things that are always going to be the same, like making sure you have enough water and snacks and some layers. But one of the greatest things about New England, of course, is that we have four very distinct seasons, and that means we have to prep differently. And I think one of the things that is challenging with spring hiking is that, as you know, you said, we're all so excited to get outside and finally see the sunshine. But when you're hiking, especially when you are hiking at higher elevations, up in the White Mountains, for example, sometimes we forget that up there is still snow up high in the mountains. So it is one of those things where you could start at the trailhead and have it be in the high 70s and then get up towards the tree line and find yourself hiking through snow. And also, you know, the snow's melting, so the water levels are higher and there's a lot of mud. So there are definitely some things to take into consideration, but it is such an exciting time to hike because summer is coming.
So, Renata, the kind of hiking that Sarah was just laying out there is a commitment. I've always wondered, if you're just walking in the woods, is it still a hike?
You know, I've started my series of the pandemic walks.
Yes.
I've called them walks, not hikes. To me, that's a little bit of a lower mental barrier to get out and do it. You know, whether it's a 15-minute thing or if I have an hour or more. You know, the hikes I would see more of as like a weekend thing, but I'm really encouraging people to try to just walk and experience nature at whatever duration or location that they can.
So, Sarah, we asked some of our listeners, our listeners who belong to our text group, to send us some of their favorite places for hikes. And For those who'd like to join us in the future, you can join that text group by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382. Again, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. Pat from Wayland texted us, "I love Hamlin Woods in Wayland. On one hike last fall near dusk, I thought I was out there alone, but a sudden flurry of motion to my left and a bit behind me turned out to be a great horned owl who swooped and then perched on a branch just several yards from me. I didn't have nor did I need my binoculars. Mysterious and wonderful." So Renata just told us about these ephemeral flowers that she's enjoying in this short period of time. When you do these hardcore hikes, is there room to enjoy these little surprises? And what kinds of things just make you most go,
oh? Well, absolutely. I think there's always room to take your time. And especially if that's what your goal is, going out and you say, "I'm just going out to be in nature and to see everything I can see." And I do think it happens so quickly where you see trees with no leaves, and then the next week there are buds and then there are leaves. And one of the things I love is the water. And a lot, the snow is melting on the mountains and it's coming down. And so you get just beautiful, beautiful cascades, and that livens up the color and the noise, and the birds are chirping. And so I like to take my time on spring hikes and really enjoy everything that's around. And one of the nice things about spring too is a lot of the hikes, say in the White Mountains, that are a little bit shorter, a little less elevation, and often the ones that have a beautiful waterfall at the end, they get very, very busy in the summer. And before Memorial Day, we still got a few more weeks. It's a fantastic time to go with your family and enjoy those hikes that are going to get very busy and the parking's going to get crowded. But this is a great time when you can really get in there and do it without too much competition.
So, sorry, I swallowed wrong a second ago. Give me a sec.
Sure.
So, Renata, I want to pick up on that. Two things there. Less beaten paths, right? Places that you might go. Of course, after we tell people, they will maybe be more beaten paths, but less beaten paths. And also, when I was talking to Rupa Shenoy on Morning Edition this morning, telling her what we were going to talk about today, she reminded me that some people will have to take cars to get to these places. And so less beaten paths where you can still park.
That's a great question. I mean, the Blue Hills Reservation in Milton is fantastic, but it does get really, really crowded. If you are willing to go out on a day when it's rainy, that parking lot is going to be empty. It's not the quite the same experience you might have in mind, but it's going to still be a great one. Another place I love that is a little off the beaten path is Rocky Hill Wildlife Sanctuary in Groton. It only has a few parking spaces, so if you get there and it's full, come back a different day. But when you're there, you're kind of in the middle of a suburban neighborhood, but you feel like a million miles away.
So, Sarah, let's let you jump in on that. Any other suggestions you have?
I like to look for places in the White Mountains in particular that have parking lots. A lot of trailheads are just a few spots or parking on the side of the road. But for example, the Franconia Falls area in Lincoln, New Hampshire has a huge parking lot. And again, before Memorial Day, you're very likely to get spaces there. The other nice thing about that area and things I look for are places where you can park that have a bunch of different trails. So depending on what you're feeling that day, you can opt for something a little harder, or you can opt for something that's maybe more beginner or family friendly.
So Renata, Joanne from Chelmsford texted us, "Chelmsford has a vibrant open space program managed by volunteers, walking trails, community garden, free community events." And what struck me about that and what I wanted to ask you about here is we often think when we go hiking about getting away. Right. But sometimes a community may have wonderful places to walk, wonderful nature to see that really embed you in a community as well. And I wonder how you think about that and where some of your favorite community spaces are to take that walk you're encouraging everyone to take.
Yeah, there really has been a big emphasis in communities about their environment. Obviously, people are thinking about it. They're wondering, how is climate change affecting our own community? And they want to make a difference. And the best way they can do that is in their local parks. For example, at Magazine Beach, which is directly across the river from where we are right now in the studio, there is a wonderful park. It's the second largest in Cambridge. It has all kinds of multi-use, bike, walk, hike. I used to row by there on the river when I was a college student. I used to rollerblade through it because it was the 80s. It is a wonderful community space. There's all kinds of activities that people are bringing to the park from their community, whether it's dance or bird watching or getting exercise. And Mass Audubon just opened a nature center there. It's our first urban green space in the park in the historic Powder Magazine building. And we're excited to add an educational component to people's ability to go to a park that's completely within walking distance or, jump off the tee in Central Square and have a really great nature experience that you really feel like you're with other people.
So, Sarah, I'm going to pick up on that. Renata just gave us a place literally right across the street. You've given us a lot that's up north. I don't know if you can answer this, but I'm going to ask you, do you have anything out west, western Massachusetts? Yesterday we were talking about Tanglewood and the Berkshires with the BSO season out there. I've been thinking about western Mass. It's on my mind. Anything out that direction that really you love?
Yeah, I haven't done a ton of hiking in Massachusetts, but I will say one of the great things that has happened as I've maintained my blog and my Instagram account is I've created this community of people in New England who hike. And so and for anyone who's really wants to get into it, it's a great way to know, trail conditions, to ask questions, to crowdsource. And so I did ask some of my fellow hikers about Massachusetts. And one name that came up, and I may butcher the name, so I apologize, is Mahana Cobble Busquet, which is in Pittsfield. And that's a spot that is pretty, from all the reviews I've read, pretty quiet. And it starts at the base of a ski area. And I think people don't always think of hiking at ski areas. Some people love it, some people hate it. But that's one that has a beautiful ridge walk, and you actually hit two peaks along the way. So you feel like you've really accomplished something. And has some great views in the Berkshires.
That sounds beautiful. I'm going to defer to you on the pronunciation. It's not one that I know either. So,
okay.
Folks in Pittsfield, if you're listening and we butchered that, not on purpose.
We apologize.
Right. And we did at least give you a shout out. All right. So Will from Brighton texted us, Fresh Pond Loop in Cambridge, Fells in Winchester, I think. And I think Winchester is right. Rock Meadow in Waltham. Lots of places. So Renata, for people who are going to do this a lot, it's going to be beautiful weather. And we know that during this pandemic, being outside has been so important. Let's talk a little bit about safety, and let's start with bugs, because I saw my first mosquito yesterday. I was like, oh, come on. So we got to think about ticks. We got to think about mosquitoes. Is it time to be spraying up or applying or wearing long sleeves? And what are the safe ways to be out there from an insect standpoint?
Well, yes, I noticed the same thing, the kind of like gnats, black flies hatched out just this week. They can be annoying. If you wear a hat, you put a little bug spray on your hat. That can often keep them away. The ticks, unfortunately, in our climate right now are out anytime it's above 40 degrees. I'm watchful for ticks. And that just means being careful. Tuck your pants into your socks, if you don't mind the slightly dorky hiker look. But then the most important thing is just when you get home, take a shower, put all your clothes either in the wash or through the dryer, and do the full body check. As long as you get off anything that happened to jump on for a ride within the first day, you're probably going to be okay with that.
And Sarah, on another aspect of safety, I mean, you're an intrepid hiker, and you're on the line today instead of in the studio because, as I understand it, you're hungered at home, recovering
yes.
from COVID, and my
yes.
heart goes out to you. I had it at the end of December, beginning of January, and I wasn't right. I was tired for
yeah.
a long time. You
yeah.
went out on a hike at less than 100% this week. And so how do people do that safely? If they're not at their best, but they want to be out, how to
yeah.
do that safely?
Yeah. And it is one of the nice things that you can do pretty safely in terms of social distancing. I would say, make sure you're picking a place where you have, you're going to have cell service. Choose, ideally a route that if you haven't done before, someone who's done it before and can give you some details about the terrain. Another thing with COVID I've found is I just don't have the stamina. And so I'm not only looking at distance and saying, okay, realistically, maybe I'm going to do like 3 miles, but also look at elevation gain. And I think that goes for anyone who's sort of getting into hiking. It's you need to look not only at distance, but also how high am I climbing? Because an elevation gain can really take a lot out of you know, your lungs and your legs if you're not at 100%. But a great, like a walk in the woods with not a lot of elevation, I think is a wonderful way to get some fresh air and feel like a normal human again.
And Sarah, I'm sorry for this basic question, but how does one find out if one's going to have self-service somewhere?
Well, I mean, I would think in Massachusetts, you're in pretty good shape there. If you use a service like there's alltrails.com, and also there's an app for alltrails. There's another one called Gaia. These are services or and apps that you can go on and search either a specific trail, or you can search a town. So if you, where you are in Massachusetts, if you want to drive an hour, you see a town, you can search it and it'll tell you what's available for hiking, woods walking, all sorts of recreation. And in a lot of the comments and descriptions, it will let you know if there is cell service. You can pretty much assume that in the White Mountains, you're not going to have a lot of cell service. So I would stay close to home if you're not feeling 100%, and just know that you can, you know, call a friend if you need to.
Makes perfect sense. All right, before we go, Renata, shameless promotion time. Tell us about an event that's coming up that Mass Audubon's doing that you want people to know about.
Well, it starts in mere hours. It is Birdathon 2022, which is our 24-hour event of competitive birding.
I love it. I love it. Oh, my God. There's competitive birding.
And we will have 1,000 staff people and volunteers all over the state birding through the night and all into tomorrow looking for species. And it's part of a fundraiser. It's to help support all of our nature programming and conservation advocacy work. And the winning team will probably spot over 250 different species of birds.
Oh, my gosh. That's so cool. All right. Renata Pomponi, Senior Regional Director at Mass Audubon. Sarah Holman, author of the blog She Hikes Mountains. That was fun. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I have had it, boo-boo. I'm going to bust out of here.
How come, Yogi?
Every day it's the same old thing. Look at the bears. Look at the bears. Look at the bears. Sheesh.
Thanks, Yogi Bear. And as it turns out, we really better look at the bears since we're spending time outside today. Heads up that here in Massachusetts, there are roughly 5,000 black bears. In fact, Massachusetts is the third most densely populated state for the species. And their numbers are steadily growing and they're expanding to the west. So spring is also the beginning of mating season for black bears. Dating is stressful, it turns out, even for bears. So it is no wonder that this makes them a little more aggressive this time of year. All that information means we got to pay attention. And we also want to ask you, if you're in our texting group and you've had an encounter with a black bear in Massachusetts, maybe on a hike, as we were talking about, maybe in your backyard, or you've got questions about being prepared for encountering a black bear, text us right now. We can pull a couple up while we're here on the air. So give us that text. And if not, you can tweet us at Radio Boston. With us now, Dave Wattles. He is a black bear and fur bearer biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife. Dave, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I want to play a little sound here first. This is from Yosemite National Park's Facebook page from 2020. Real sound, not Yogi. And this is an actual black bear in a tree making a bellowing noise. Here it is. Now, do you usually get warning that there's a black bear in the woods that you can't see but nearby or approaching your backyard or maybe eating your bird feeder? Are they a quiet bear or is this the kind of thing you're going to hear?
No, you tend not to hear much noise with a black bear. They tend to be pretty quiet and can kind of just appear out of nowhere. And, you know, even moving through the forest, they don't make much much noise. What you had there was probably a bear in a tree with people around and trying to take pictures and things, and then it's letting people know that it's stressed. Bears can and tend to vocalize the most if they're feeling uncomfortable, and they tend to make huffing noises, jaw-popping noises. They can bluff charge, and it's just kind of trying to let people or whatever's threatening them know you're a little too close, time to back off, and that should resolve the situation. But generally speaking, they're pretty quiet.
Okay, so let's stay with that for a second. Should you hear that sound or spy a black bear, let's hit this right at the top. What do you do? Do you play dead? Do you get loud? Do you turn and run? Do you stand still? What do you do?
Yeah, the big thing is we're black bears aren't an inherently aggressive species. So
Are not.
So a brown bear, which is found out in the Rocky Mountains and in Canada, Alaska, is much larger and much more aggressive species. Black bears don't tend to be at all. And so you don't have to immediately drop and play dead. If someone's hiking in a trail or they see a bear in the backyard, it's just important to give the bear space and recognize that it is still a large and powerful animal, so not try to get closer to take a photo or anything like that, but back up and move away. So slowly just raise your hands. You can talk to it in a calm, assertive voice. Just, hey, bear, I'm here. Just want to let you know I'm here. I'm now going to back up and let you do your business. And basically you're just trying to let it know you're there in case it doesn't.
Oh, so you don't want to catch it by surprise and have
exactly.
It.
So
gotcha.
Exactly. So all of a sudden it's not super close to you when it first realizes you're there. That's when it's more likely to potentially react in a negative way, but more defensive way, where all of a sudden it's just like, whoa, you're super close, and it might swat or something. So it's just, if you see it from a distance, just talk to it. Increase the space with the animal, and you should be fine.
So where are they? So who needs to hear this, right? Where in Massachusetts might you have the risk of startling a black bear unless you talk to it carefully and quietly and back away?
Yep. More and more people in reality in Massachusetts are living amongst black bears on a daily basis. The western two-thirds of the state certainly are where we have resident black bears and increasing densities of bears. So there's regular interaction, you know, everywhere west of Worcester, certainly. In the northern tier of the state, north of Route 2, our bear range goes all the way over to 495. We're increasingly getting reports of individual bears in between 190 and 495, inside of 495 in places like Concord. And obviously there was a bear that moved all throughout Southeast Mass last year. And so more and more people are interacting with bears on a daily basis in Massachusetts.
How do you know there was one bear moving around Southeast Massachusetts? Are you tracking them? I understand you do research.
We do research to track bears, but that's one in these places where we don't have resident bears. My phone rings off the hook. We get calls, local police get calls. It pops up in the media because it's a novel thing in those towns. So generally speaking, that bear, we were able to track town to town to town as it moved through, just based on the calls that came into us, media reports and those kind of things. So we didn't need, you know, any kind of sophisticated tracking to monitor what was happening with that bear.
So I this gives me wonder, right? How do you know it's one bear? How do you know it's not like a bunch of bears and one's living in one place and one's living in another place, but they're all popping up this year? I mean, it sounds silly when I ask it, but I do wonder.
Yep. And there's possible in some of these places that there are more than one individual. But as I was saying, kind of, you know, it will progress from, you know, one town to the neighboring town to the neighboring town and move in progression. And the calls from the original town disappear. So you can generally assume that it is a single bear moving through. But also over time, as bears become more common, you know, if a bear was seen in town last year, maybe those calls don't come into the police, don't come into us, because it's not as big a thing. So there is that reporting issue as well in terms of knowing how many bears are now interacting and living in this very low density range in the eastern part of Massachusetts.
So as I understand it, you have some bears with collars and you actually go into their dens towards the end of hibernation to check on them, see if they have cubs, etc. One, how do you do that safely? And two, have you done that this year? What'd you find?
Yep. We have about 35 female bears collared with tracking collars. And so those collars allow us to monitor the bear throughout the year, determine whether or not she survives from whenever we handled her the previous time through the entire year to the denning period. It allows us to learn about the causes of mortality in the population. And by tracking the females, we can learn about their cub production and their cub survival as well. So this time of year, we're actively trapping to try to collar new bears. And then we monitor them throughout the year. And then each winter we go in, we locate the dens. And then in January, February, and March, we go in and we attempt to immobilize or tranquilize the female in the den. If she has newborn cubs, we can determine how many cubs she has. If she has one-year-old cubs with her, we can attempt to immobilize them or at least document how many of those cubs she had. So this is how we're learning about the biology and the inherent population demographics of bears in the state, and that's what we use to inform our management decisions.
What is your most memorable? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish.
No, I was just going to say, you know, this past year we handled 27 females in the den. On average, with newborn cubs, they're giving birth to two or three cubs, as many as four we've documented with our research bears. We have had reports of females with five cubs in the past. And so, you know, over the time we've been doing this study going all the way back to the 1980s, we have a very good image of what's happening with in terms of reproductive rates and survival rates for bears in Massachusetts.
Your most memorable black bear encounter?
It's probably one of the first ones when I was a postdoc at UMass and I was first doing trapping. We had successfully trapped and collared a female in the trap one morning. We got back to the truck and there was a female standing at the base of a tree just next to the truck. I was able to mix up some drug, load my tranquilizer dart gun and actually dart her. And we were able to collar two females in about a half an hour one day for the research project. So that was definitely a memorable experience.
It sounds like it. All right. In our last, just a very short amount of time here, probably best to be Team Black Bear from afar. So what steps should you take to actually keep them out of your yard or your neighborhood in a thoughtful pro-bear way?
Yep. A lot of people look to me and we get calls saying, you know, you're the bear biologist. You need to do something about the bears in our yards, the bears in our community. In reality, there's very little I can do without the public's help. The reason bears are in people's yards is because of food sources. Bird feeders being the number one that really attracts bears to people's yards and trains them to come to yards to try to find food. So we need the public to remove the bird feeders, to secure their garbage, and to clean up any food sources around their property. If they do that, they're going to greatly reduce the amount of time bears spend around our homes, which is what we want to have happen. We're increasingly seeing a lot of conflict with bears and chickens. I just got a call about one of our collared females raiding a chicken coop today. And we're really encouraging everyone who has backyard chickens and bees to be using electric fencing. It's safe around kids, safe around pets, and is about the only thing that can keep bears from destroying your property and also learning bad behaviors.
All right, that is Dave Wattles. He is a black bear and fur bearer biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife. Dave, it was great to learn about the black bears. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
We'll be back after a break. This is Radio Boston.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Weeknd.
Yay, Weeknd! Got weekend plans? Okay, maybe you don't. Maybe the week was busy enough that you have not been able to think ahead one little bit. And in anticipation of that, we bring you our new regular The Weeknd segment to give you some thoughts of what you can do. Joining us now, WBUR Senior Arts and Culture Reporter, Cristela Guerra. Cristela, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana.
So I hear that you've brought us a nice mix of goings-on, both here in Boston and out in the surrounding areas. I want to start with some Shakespeare. Theater lovers will recognize this clip. Let's take a listen.
Marry, our play is the most lamentable comedy and most cruel death of Pyramus and Thisbe.
A very good piece of work, I assure you, and a Mary. Now, good Peter Quince, call forth your actors by the scroll. Masters, spread yourselves.
Answer as I call you. Nick Bottom, the weaver.
Ready, name what part I am for and proceed.
Ah, Pyramus and Thisbe. That was Commonwealth Shakespeare Company's production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. So tell us about the play, why you're recommending it, where it's going to be. Bring us there.
Absolutely. So Dorchester, the Strand Theater, 7 p.m. on Saturday. It's interesting. There was a big focus on accessibility with this specific company. They were, I interviewed some accessibility advocates last week. I talked to the director of artistic sign language when they discussed just trying to interpret this play. There were some complications COVID-wise, but it is an abridged play. It'll be a little shorter, and it's definitely meant to be kid-friendly. So I think for families, it's just going to be a lot of fun.
So a little shorter, once I saw Hamlet in a movie theater, it was the full production. It was 5 hours long. So what is a little shorter? What should families plan on? Do you know how long this play roughly is?
Yeah, I think it's just under 2 hours. And it's made more for like a high school curriculum. You know, it's for teachers and students. This will be for, you know, I think they're just addressing certain themes and they're letting people know ahead of time what they're going to be dealing with in terms of this Shakespearean comedy and what they're not in advance. So people can find that online.
All right. Really like that family-friendly focus in Dorchester with the Commonwealth Shakespeare Company. Now you're going to take us dancing. Take me dancing. Take me dancing.
I'm going dancing this weekend.
Yay!
We gotta go. We can do this. So Let's Dance Boston, outdoor dancing on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday afternoon. It's Friday and Saturday night at the Rose Kennedy Greenway. So tonight we've got West Coast Swing. Tomorrow night, salsa. And Sunday afternoon, I'm so sorry, it's Garba. It's a type of dance from India. I am very excited about the salsa. I admit I'm Alcera. I will absolutely be there.
So this is outdoors. Yes. So for the COVID minded, you can come and do this safely.
Absolutely. You can dance. You don't have to partner dance. You can kind of dance. There's some distance between the two of you. If there's concerns, wear masks, whatever you need to do.
Okay. Now let's get out of Boston for a minute. Cristela, you've brought us some kid friendly activity at the DeCordova Sculpture Park in Lincoln. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I love the DeCordova. It's just really gorgeous in every season. And you can appreciate art inside the museum and out. So there's two walks. One is kid-friendly. It's for parents specifically. It's 8:30 in the morning for an hour, and it's only $6. And then there's one in the afternoon for those who don't want to wake up that early on a Saturday, like me. starts at 1 o'clock. It's $18, and this is their springtime guided tour. I think the tulips are blooming. It's in Lincoln. Highly recommend. The DeCordova is great.
Okay, so just I want to cue in on this for listeners. So the morning is less expensive than the afternoon. $6 in the morning, $18 in the afternoon.
Yeah, they're calling the morning their Sculpture Park Tour for parents. So anybody with babies encouraged for this 45-minute walk.
Okay, and the last one you brought us is Fun at the Forge. I'm curious. Tell me about that.
It looks like a blast. I mean, it's in Medfield. It's at the Belforge Arts Center. There's a group art projects, sing-alongs, a puppet show, a science exhibition, and it's a free family festival, so 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And, you know, I think there'll be just a diversity of things for people to do. It's the weekend's supposed to be gorgeous, Tiziana. It's going to be really nice out.
So I want you to take me back to the dancing because I know you're a big salsa fan. So it's free. Can you not be a good dancer and go to something like this, or is that just a giant opportunity for embarrassment?
Everybody come out. There was actually Mambo this week. Salsa is different. So Mambo is more of a trumpet heavy salsa, you know, is a bit more of a, you can kind of dance to it however way you want. The way I see it, I was raised with it and God knows I didn't always do it right, but it's open. Everybody should come out and try it.
And anything else that you're looking forward to this weekend, just for you, for Cristela?
I just want to lay in the grass. I've been waiting for the sunshine for such a long time. I'm so excited to just lay in the grass, maybe on the beach. I don't know. We'll see where it takes me. I might go bike riding.
All right. That is Cristela Guerra, senior arts and culture reporter here at WBUR. Always great to talk to you. Thank you for bringing us into the weekend.
Thanks so much.
All right. That is our show for today. That is our show for the week. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles with Francisca Monahan and Sarah Leeson. We had help today from Amy Moon. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer. I am Tiziana Deering. You are a fantastic listener. Thanks for tuning in for our new 11 a.m. live or 3 p.m. Hear it again this week. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.